All right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Friday, September 11th. Yes, it is 2015. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Friday, everybody. And unhappy 9/11. Sad that we've made it here again. Hopefully nothing bad happens today. It is 58 degrees and very dark and cloudy here in upstate New York. I'm not sure it's going to get very warm today. We're going to take a look at a bunch of things today, but where do we leave off yesterday? We titled the show DNA Databasing, Genome App Store, and Alzheimer's, and we ended the show with a story out of Scientific American showing that how they think now that Alzheimer's may be transmissible from person to person, which was extremely disturbing. So we're going to get back there. 23andMe, DNA sampling, DNA databasing, and there's all kinds of crazy shit that I think we're going to dig back into for our Friday. But before we get there, let me just connect my call. I ran across a video this morning that I'd seen before. It was Corbett Report. I'm sure many of you have maybe caught it at one point in the past, but Corbett Report did a great 4 minute and 55 seconds video that pretty much summed up everything that happened on 9/11 in less than 5 minutes. I thought that with it being 9/11 today, this would be quite appropriate. So let's kick off the show here. If it plays. That's like the problem we run into is like the second you want to go play it, it's not there and it's spinning on me. So hold on. Oh my God. Thank God it's Friday. That's all I got to say. And do I get to sing? Do I get to sing? Oh my God. Literally, like, it was just cued. It was ready to play. All I had to do was hit the play button and it was ready to rock and roll. And now it is just spinning. So hold on. Wait a minute. There we go.
On the morning of September 11th, 2001, 19 men armed with box cutters directed by a man on dialysis in a cave fortress halfway around the world using a satellite phone and a laptop directed the most sophisticated penetration of the most heavily defended airspace in the world, overpowering the passengers and the military combat trained pilots on four commercial aircraft before flying those planes wildly off course for over an hour without being molested by a single fighter interceptor. These 19 hijackers, devout religious fundamentalists who like to drink alcohol, snort cocaine, and live with pink-haired strippers, managed to knock down three buildings with two planes in New York. While in Washington, a pilot who couldn't handle a single-engine Cessna was able to fly a 757 in an 8,000-foot descending 270-degree corkscrew turn to come exactly level with the ground, hitting the Pentagon in the budget analyst office where DOD staffers were working on the mystery of the $2.3 trillion that Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld had announced missing from the Pentagon's coffers in a press conference the day before, on September 10th, 2001. Luckily, the news anchors knew who did it within minutes.
Osama bin Laden.
The pundits knew within hours.
Osama bin Laden.
The administration knew within the day.
Terrorists who committed these acts and those who harbor them.
And the evidence literally fell into the FBI's lap.
That a hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
But for some reason, a bunch of crazy conspiracy theorists demanded an investigation into the greatest attack on American soil in history. That investigation was delayed, underfunded, set up to fail, a conflict of interest, and a cover-up from start to finish. It was based on testimony extracted through torture, the records of which were destroyed. It failed to mention the existence of WTC-7, Able Danger, PTEC, Sibel Edmonds, OBL and the CIA, and the drills of hijacked aircraft being flown into buildings that were being simulated at the precise same time that those events were actually happening. It was lied to by the Pentagon, the CIA, the Bush administration, and as for Bush and Cheney, well, no one knows what they told it because they testified in secret, off the record, not under oath, and behind closed doors. It didn't bother to look at who funded the attacks because that question is ultimately of little practical significance. Still, the 9/11 Commission did brilliantly, answering all of the questions the public had, except most of the victims' family members' questions, and pinned blame on all the people responsible, although no one so much as lost their job, determining the attacks were
failure of imagination.
Because
nobody in our government, at least, and I don't think the prior government that could envision flying airplanes into buildings.
except the Pentagon, FEMA, NORAD, and the NRO. The DIA destroyed 2.5 terabytes of data on Able Danger, but that's okay because it probably wasn't important. The SEC destroyed their records on the investigation into the insider trading before the attacks, but that's okay because destroying the records of the largest investigation in SEC history is just part of routine record keeping. NIST has classified the data that they used for their model of WTC-7's collapse, but that's okay because knowing how they made their model of the collapse would jeopardize public safety. The FBI has argued that all material related to their investigation of 9/11 should be kept secret from the public, but that's okay because the FBI probably has nothing to hide. This man never existed, nor is anything he had to say worthy of your attention, and if you say otherwise, you are a paranoid conspiracy theorist and deserve to be shunned by all of humanity. Likewise, him, and her. And her, and her, and him. Osama bin Laden lived in a cave fortress in the hills of Afghanistan, but somehow got away. Then he was hiding out in Tora Bora, but somehow got away. Then he lived in Abbottabad for years, taunting the most comprehensive intelligence dragnet employing the most sophisticated technology in the history of the world for a decade, releasing video after video with complete impunity and getting younger and younger as he did so, before finally being found in a daring SEAL team raid which wasn't recorded on video, in which he didn't resist or use his wife as a human shield, and in which these crack special forces operatives panicked and killed this unarmed man, supposedly the best source of intelligence about those dastardly terrorists on the entire planet. Then they dumped his body in the ocean before telling anyone about it. Then a couple dozen of that team's members died in a helicopter crash in Afghanistan. This is the story of 9/11, brought to you by the media, which told you the hard truths about...
His head could be seen to move violently forward.
And...
They took the babies out of incubators.
And...
Mobile production facilities.
And...
The rescue of Jessica Lynch.
If you have any questions about this story, you are a batshit, paranoid, tinfoil, dog-abusing baby hater, and will be reviled by everyone. If you love your country and or freedom, happiness, rainbows, rock and roll, puppy dogs, apple pie, and your grandma, you will never ever express doubts about any part of this story to anyone. Ever. This has been a public service announcement by the friends of the FBI, CIA, NSA, DIA, SEC, MSM, White House, NIST, and the 9/11 Commission. Because ignorance is strength.
Go Corbett. That was awesome. You know, one of the things, this is from 2011, and one of the things that came out after this video was released was the fact that they had released what was on Osama bin Laden's bookcase. Remember, they didn't mention the porn in this, and they didn't mention that he had been reading 9/11 conspiracy books. So I don't know, you know. The fact that here we are still 14 years later, and I saw a video this morning of somebody doing a feet on the street showing Building 7 collapsing on a college campus and asking people what their thoughts were. And the fact that most of the college kids had no idea that Building 7 collapsed. Those who were let in on what they were looking at all of a sudden got all freaked out and said, oh, not one of those conspiracies about 9/11 to want anything to do with that. I have to say that as a society, I think we're pretty doomed as far as asking questions, believing your own two eyes, and even questioning the official narrative. So I'm going to leave it at that. I mean, we've done so many 9/11 specials over the years. I don't think there's really a lot more to say unless people really want to do a 9/11 show today. I guess you could call in and we could save the DNA continuation with this transmissible Alzheimer's for Monday. But let's just hope that nothing, no false flags happen today. No crazy kill whoever happens today. I heard all kinds of nutty shit for today. So... anyway, I feel bad for everything that happened, for the people that lost their lives, for how this created the march toward where we are today with the bag closing over our heads, the complete and utter takedown of any type of personal privacy, liberty, or sovereignty. I mean, that was the first step to stepping into the portal of doom. All right, anyway, let's get back to where we left off yesterday. So the story before last that we read was titled Body Clock Blood Test Can Detect Biological Age and Predict Alzheimer's Risk. And what was interesting is that it was something in your blood. They were looking at some of the telltale signs in the blood. It says the study published in the journal Genome Biology on Monday shows that this test can distinguish between healthy individuals and patients with Alzheimer's. A significant difference was found in the genetic signatures of those with mild cognitive problems, such as early dementia, and people healthy in the same age group. This means that the test could potentially be used to identify those in the early stages of the disease but who have not developed symptoms yet. And one of the things that is interesting about this is typically dementia and some of the other diseases besides Alzheimer's. We kind of went through them yesterday. The Krupchev's Jacobs disease, mad cow disease, scrapie in animals, right? All of those diseases that are brain wasting all seem to have similar patterns, similar things that happen in the brain. And one of the things that we had looked at was malformed proteins. And the story out of Scientific American had addressed that and kind of made a connection here. It says evidence for a person-to-person transmission of Alzheimer's pathology. So we only made it through like the first paragraph here before the show was over. So let's start here. So there's a lot more that I dug up. It says prions are misshapen proteins that replicate by inducing normal proteins to misfold and aggregate in the brain, leading to rare diseases, so they say rare, such as mancow and kuru, and that is the disease that the Pacific Islanders had after eating brain material of infected individuals. In recent years, scientists have discovered that similar processes of protein misfolding are also at work in many neurodegenerative disorders, including Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and Lou Gehrig's. And I mean, it's just so amazing to me when I start looking back at good old George Bush again. Another George Bush moment in time when mad cow was first identified in the food chain. Good old George Bush was president, and they were fully invested, if not him, all of his buddies in cattle farming. They really kind of brushed over it quick and made it sound as if it were not a problem. There were countries that were kind of freaking out, wouldn't import our beef, and they changed their whole process of not allowing downed cows into the food chain, getting rid of all that neurological material with the spinal cord and the brain and whatever from getting into the food chain, so they said, and waved a magic wand, and mad cow disease was never heard of again. I think there was one case I've seen since then that's been documented in the public literature. But the interesting part about this is that typically any of these neurodegenerative diseases don't happen immediately. They take 10 to 20 years to manifest themselves. And so when you take a look at how long it's been, a good 20 years or so since we first started hearing about these cases, and we start seeing now that there is just such a blooming overgrowth of neurodegenerative diseases, even in young people 30 to 40 years old, it really makes one scratch their head when now we hear that there is this very similar process between Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, Lou Gehrig's, and mad cow. What? All right. Anyway, now a study in Nature reveals that the first evidence for human-to-human transmission of misfolded proteins that underlie the pathology of Alzheimer's disease. Now, they had already, and we discussed this yesterday, we had already heard that there were sterilization issues with anyone who had been in contact with that Creutzfeldt-Jacobs disease, the CJD or the VCJD, and mad cow. They were having issues. They couldn't kill it because the protein wasn't actually alive. It was a protein. And I found research material yesterday that was dated back from 2001. That's just so sick, because even though in 2001, how interesting, same year as 9/11, but how messed up is it that they already knew back at that time that there were issues, that you couldn't kill it, that sterilization wasn't getting rid of it, and that it was transmissible even in surgical procedures. But here is the study out of Oxford Journal that I see this whole thing listed out of all the issues with sterilization. And at the very bottom, it says low-risk tissues. And this is low-risk tissues that we really don't need to worry about. They are defined as the kidney, liver, spleen, lung, and lymph nodes from a high-risk patient and a critical or semi-critical medical device. Says we don't really have to worry about them. They can be disinfected or sterilized by the use of conventional protocols of heat or chemical sterilization. And then they listed the no-risk tissues. And that's defined as the peripheral nerve, the intestine, the bone marrow, the blood, leukocytes, serum, thyroid gland, adrenal glands, heart, skeletal muscle, gingiva, which I'm not even sure what that is, prostate, testes, placenta, tears, nasal mucus, saliva, sputum, urine, feces, semen, vaginal secretions, and milk from a high-risk patient and critical or semi-critical medical device. So all of these things haven't, they were listed as no-risk tissues that we don't really need to do anything besides conventional means for any devices that came into any contact with these things during surgical procedures, including endoscopes, mind you, for your colonoscopies. Also, environmental surfaces contaminated with no-risk tissues or fluids. Don't worry about it. Just use disinfectants. I mean, it's pretty sick that these were the recommendations as of 2000 and 2001. So let's all be happy. Don't worry about it. But now we have a study showing that we have the same or similar malformed proteins happening with Alzheimer's. It wasn't just what they said, this rare case of Kutchubs-Jacobs disease. Alzheimer's is now at an epidemic level across the world. Anyway, let's get back to the story. So Nature, in the study, reveals the first evidence for human-to-human transmission of the misfolded proteins that underlie the pathology of Alzheimer's. The new findings draw upon an earlier research conducted on prion disease between the years of 58 and 1985. And this is like the most twisted study I've ever heard. A number of individuals with short stature, and that was that one disorder called Bloom syndrome that we discovered that 23andMe was also doing genetic testing for. A number of individuals with short stature received shots of human growth hormone that was extracted from the pituitary gland of cadavers. The gland is a pea-sized structure that sits at the base of the brain, and some of these samples were contaminated with prions that caused certain patients to develop Creutzfeldt-Jacobs disease, CJD for short, a rare and fatal brain disorder. And that pretty much is known as the human equivalent of the bovine spongiform encephalopathy, more commonly known as MAD-CAU. Treatment ceased once these reports came to light, but by that time, an estimated 30,000 people had already received the injections. And I mean, who on earth would be getting injections from cadaver pituitaries? Like, how crazy is that? As of 2012, researchers had identified 450 cases of CJD worldwide that are the result of these growth hormone injections and other medical procedures, including neurosurgery and transplants. Misfolding of the amyloid beta proteins is a hallmark of Alzheimer's, and it is misfolding of the proteins is also a hallmark of MAD-CAU. Previous studies have shown, as well as CJD, previous studies have shown that minute amounts of amyloid beta injected into animals such as mice or monkeys act as the seeds that initiate a chain reaction of protein misfolding that resembles the pathology of Alzheimer's. However, until now, no studies have found evidence that this process occurs in humans. But what's so odd is that they had already found evidence that there were issues with sterilization procedures with different diseases that included those with misfolded proteins, and that they could be transmitted through medical procedures. So I don't really understand where they're like doing a eureka moment that they didn't know. I mean, that study that I was reading about sterilization procedures was from the years 2000 to 2001. To explore the question of transmission, John Collingay, a neuroscientist at the University College London, and his colleagues conducted an autopsy study of 8 patients who died from CJD after treatment with cadaver-derived growth factor. And to their surprise, they found that 6 of the brains had amyloid beta pathology found in Alzheimer's patients, and 4 exhibited some degree of cerebral amyloid angiography, in which the amyloid deposits built up on the walls of blood vessels in the brain. The patients were between the ages of 36 and 51, typically too young to exhibit Alzheimer's pathology, and none of the individuals bore genetic mutations associated with the early onset of the disease. All evidence points toward one possibility. Like prions, amyloid beta seeds were in the growth hormone injections and infected these individuals. And although none of the brains showed any other Alzheimer's disease markers, such as buildup of another misfolded protein called Tau, the researchers suggest that the patients had not died young, they would have developed the disease later in life. This may be a first step to answering the questions of whether human-to-human transmission of a pathological protein is possible. This is an observable study, and we are simply describing what we see in these patients, and we are trying to explain that. He says the study alone does not suffice to prove Alzheimer's disease can be induced in one individual through contact with another's brain tissue. And in a follow-up study, the researchers are hoping to obtain archived batches of the cadaver-derived human growth hormone to look for presence of telltale small clusters of amyloid beta. And this goes on and on and on. It says in another study published today in the Nature Neuroscience, Matthias Jucker from that University of Tübingen study in Germany and colleagues, including Larry Walker, found that amyloid beta seeds have the ability to persist in the brain for months and regain pathogenic properties when introduced to the right environment. Together with the evidence that Alzheimer's pathology can be transmitted between humans, scientists are starting to look carefully at the ways in which a range of neurodegenerative diseases may develop over the course of decades and the role that transmission between humans may play. I think we all agree that a more systemic approach in this area is necessary. And how scary is that? Like, so now after all these years, they're going, maybe this can be transmitted from one person to another, and maybe the way that we've been sterilizing things hasn't actually been sterilizing them, because we've had evidence that sterilizing by standard procedure does not actually kill malformed proteins. Well, then I saw a story, so it's from yesterday, I saw a story that came out of RT. I saw it this morning. This actually was published late last night. Alzheimer's disease might be transmitted by blood transfusions, surgery, and hormone treatment. Donated blood and contaminated surgical instruments are now feared to be transmitters of Alzheimer's disease, scientists have said after studying brains during autopsy of patients who have been treated with the human growth hormone extracted from cadavers. An autopsy of people who have been treating with the HGH as children has revealed that their brains had a pathology that is vastly associated with Alzheimer's disease, according to scientists at the University College at London. The research cast doubt on previous beliefs that could mean that the lethal disease could be transmitted through contaminated human and medical material. The discovery outlined in a study published in the journal Nature, which we just read about, was made during research of different neurological disorder, that is Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease, CJD, and it is known to be transmitted via surgery, which is what I said. I mean, that was known. Blood and hormone treatment, and is now believed to be the same to be true for Alzheimer's. Human growth hormone taken from the brains of human cadavers was used to treat growth disorders in children up until 1985, when the link between HGH and CJD was discovered. But could it be just one of the potential transmitters along with donated blood and surgical aid? British researchers have studied the cases of only 8 patients who died from CJD in their middle years, and their unusual cases have revealed that 6 of them could have also suffered from Alzheimer's despite having no clinical symptoms of the disease, which has a long incubation period, like I said. CJD is an incurable and rare degenerative neurological disorder, and basically makes your brain look like Swiss cheese from everything that I've read, sometimes referred to as human forms of mad cow disease. And that's exactly what I discovered in my research. It is transmitted by infectious defective proteins or prions, and it is not clear if poorly sterilized surgical instruments can be their carrier. But like I said, I've seen lots of research to that fact since the fact that when they first found that they thought it was being transmitted that way and that they couldn't kill it with heat or chemicals. With about 1 in a million people age 60 plus suffering, CJD can also be inherited or sporadic, and the latter being a more widespread type. And what I found curious, though, is like they say 1 in a million, and now they're discovering that Alzheimer's is very similar in the way it works with very similar malformed prions. And it makes me wonder if these aren't all one and the same or a variant of one and the same of the same disease. So then it wouldn't be 1 in a million. It would be an epidemic of people with neurodegenerative disorders, just like we're seeing now. We've learned a lot about decontamination from our experience with We have learned a lot about decontamination from our experience with CJD, says neuropathologist Charles Dickerites at the Petit-Saint-Tropez Hospital in Paris. But this is a wake-up call to the medical community to be particularly vigilant. And although scientists fall short of providing the final proof of Alzheimer's disease being transmitted by medical means, they clarify that there is no ground for fears. Of course there isn't. Don't worry about it, because we're working on all kinds of DNA switch-flipping, ultrasound, blood vessel, brain-blood barrier opening, money-making technologies to make certain that we can maybe cure what ails you. Says there is no ground for fear that it could be infectious, triggered by a mere person-to-person contact. An independent replication of the research is planned to take place in France, and the possible confirmation of a newly discovered means of Alzheimer's transmission would demonstrate the necessity of major changes in surgical practice and funding of public health services. Now, excuse me, but if there is even an iota of chance that something that is epidemic throughout the globe right now could be transmissible through simple surgical procedures or blood transfusions, I would say let's screw the independent study before we're sure, and let's implement some like level 4 biohazard procedures right now. Why would you not? And these are the people that are supposed to be keeping us safe. Why would you not do that? Well, like I said, don't worry about it, because guess what? It has been announced that personal genetics company 23andMe has launched in the UK an Alzheimer's test with their Google-funded DNA kit. Yes, they have. So don't worry about it, because 23andMe will be on to that like a fly on shit. Personal genetics company 23andMe is launched in the UK, analyzing customers' data, DNA data for genetic risk factors for conditions, including Alzheimer's disease and hereditary cancers. 23andMe is launched in the UK, giving you the chance to examine not only your genetic health and ancestry, but also traits and predictions for having diseases thanks to your genes. And from a simple saliva test, more than 100 detailed genetic reports are generated and stored in an online database. And while not intended to diagnose disease, the 125-pound testing kit, not pounds, but pounds as in dollars, can flag up genetic risk factors, including Alzheimer's disease, hereditary breast and ovarian cancer, and Parkinson's, alongside how you may react to drugs that are used to treat epilepsy and hepatitis C. So they'll know whether or not, you know, they can develop new drugs. We read about 23andMe starting a new drug development division as well yesterday. Says it can also reveal if you are a carrier of recessive genetic variants for conditions including cystic fibrosis, polycystic disease, kidney disease, and sickle cell anemia, which would be passed down to your future offspring, of course, making you bad breeding stock. The company, which is partially funded by Google, and we found out also the CEO is Google co-founder Sergey Brin's wife, uses genotyping technology to identify the specific genetic variants within an individual's genome, which contains interesting information about their health and heritage. A U.S. laboratory extracts the DNA from the customer's saliva sample and places it on an Illumina genotyping chip, which we read about Illumina yesterday. Illumina was the company that was spinning off the new company called Helix to create a DNA genome app store that people could subscribe to. So for $29.95, you can download an application that'll tell you if, oh, I don't know, you have superior genetics, let's say. So Illumina is like the back end to 23andMe, it seems. Incubation encourages the hybridization process in which the DNA attaches itself to beads on a chip, and then the chip is then analyzed by a computer, which sends the extracted and encrypted data to 23andMe. Co-founder Ann Wojcicki, we talked about her yesterday, that's Sergey Brin's wife, said that the service was intended to help people. Yes, it was. Learn more about themselves in a private and accessible way. Of course, as we stick all your data into an online database and you check the box that, yes, we can also utilize your data for scientific research. It says, 23andMe users can choose to share their anonymized data with researchers in the world's largest online genetic research platform of more than 600,000 sets of data. And the story read yesterday says of June of 2015, they were at 1 million sets of data. Users also have the potential to discover and communicate with relatives through the DNA relative feature. And yes, that was their great way of making money, since the FDA told 23andMe they could not, quote unquote, diagnose disease in the United States. They are now peddling this as an ancestry location tool. Says a source at the Department of Health, and this must be in the UK, has said that the product being offered in the UK has a CE mark, meaning that it meets their legal requirements, and has added that 23andMe is following the principles set out by the Human Genetics Commission of 2010 on direct-to-consumer genetic testing. The spokesman said, quote, this government is developing the use of genomics for patient care with the National Health Science Institute. And I'm going to tell you what, guys, that is also what is happening in the United States. We found out that 23andMe also had announced a partnership with the U.S.'s National Institute of Health. So how interesting is that? Is that we have Obama announcing in January of 2015 that the U.S. is to develop the DNA study of up to 1 million people as part of his precision healthcare initiative. This is in MIT Technology Review. The U.S. to develop a DNA study of 1 million people. An Obama initiative seeks to channel a torrent of gene information into treatments for cancer. Yes, the big dangling carrot. We're going to cure your cancer and other diseases. Barack Obama, January 30th, 2015, is proposing to spend $215 million on a, quote, precision medicine, unquote, initiative, the centerpiece of which will be the national study involving the health records and DNA of, oh, 1 million volunteers. Yes, there must have been the 1 million people as of June 2015 that had all checked that box. Which it wasn't, they said it wasn't 1 million that had checked the box, but there at one point, I think there was 650,000 that had checked that box to use my DNA data for scientific purposes. So a whole 1 million volunteers, administration officials said on January 29th. Precision medicine refers to treatments tailored to a person's genetic profile, an idea already transforming how doctors fight cancer and some rare diseases. The Obama plan, including support for studies of cancer and rare diseases, is part of a shift away from a one-size-fits-all medicine that we have today. Joe Handelsman, Associate Director for the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, said in a briefing. She called precision medicine a, quote, game changer that holds the potential to revolutionize how we approach health in this country and around the world. I got a little clippy here, and if we can get it to work, hold on, let's see. So how is all of this information that is being taken about you? Genetic information, of course, is the ultimate biometrics. Let's see if we can get this to rock and roll.
This episode is brought to you by AJ Plus. Recently, President Obama announced a new program to create a pool of DNA samples from 1 million volunteers. This would be just one of many government-run DNA databases around the world, ones proposed for a variety of well-meaning reasons, like healthcare and preventing crimes. But many people are worried that this precision medicine is the ultimate example of Big Brother and another step in ending privacy for good. So, are DNA databases worth it? The first DNA database was started in the UK in 1995. Soon, other countries followed suit. A 2008 Interpol study of 149 countries found that 54 nations had a national DNA database and 26 others planned to start one. For the most part, these databases started as a way to track and catch criminals. And this worked. Using its own DNA database, the US's FBI has helped solve innumerable crimes. These cases have even exonerated innocent people who are facing execution. And Chinese police have also set up a DNA database that has connected over 2,000 kidnapped children with their parents. But the effectiveness of using DNA is not what people are concerned about. It's how large these databases are growing. Originally, DNA was only collected from people who were convicted of crimes. However, now in countries like the United States, DNA samples are taken from people even if they are simply suspected of or questioned about a crime. This has grown the FBI database into the largest in the world, with more than 3.5% of the country's DNA on file. If Obama's new DNA program is deemed a success, then it's not unthinkable that one day most of the population's DNA will be filed by the government. Advocates of the scheme suggest that the general population shouldn't be fearful of the new proposal, as the database would only be utilized to support healthcare initiatives and catch criminals.
Right. That's all it's going to be used for, I'm sure.
But while this could mean crimes are easier to solve, experts worry that the mismanagement of such a system could leave the database open to hackers. And other skeptics are concerned that supporting the new program is one step closer to mandatory DNA samples for every man, woman, and child in the country. What do you think about DNA databases? Should all countries adopt them? Let us know in the comments and make sure to subscribe to get all the latest test tube videos.
All right, well, there you go. And there was just a story, and I think Brandon Turbeville actually did it, in regards to biometrics. One of the Middle Eastern countries, and I was thinking Qatar, but it's not. Oh, hold on. National DNA. They had just made national DNA databasing mandatory, and it was going to be not only from people who live there, but even people who were residents and resident aliens. And I don't see the country right off the bat, but I guess the United Kingdom and the United States have national DNA databases already. Like you said, the FBI, crime intelligence, and they have now made it a requirement when you're arrested, even if you're not convicted of a crime, to give DNA. But here's something even more disturbing that I ran across. This is from just over a year ago, August of 2014. And people have talked about this before. I remember when I was giving birth to my daughter that they also did the blood test. It says every year approximately 4 million newborns in the United States are screened for congenital disorders, with about 12,500 of these infants being diagnosed with an inherited condition. Many of these disorders, one such like something called PKU, can be effectively treated when caught early, allowing an infant to grow and develop normally. By every account, newborn screening is one of modernity's biggest medical success stories. Yet most of us are not familiar with this compelling tale or even know that we most likely have been screened. Yeah, well, that's the good news, they say. The bad news is what we may not be aware of is that many states have created biobanks funded by genetic material left over from our newborn screening tests. And even more surprising, our specimens may be used for purposes we do not fully understand or for which we have not granted informed consent. Massachusetts began the original newborn screening program back in 1963 with a test for PKU. And this is out of Newsweek, by the way. And though few babies were found to have the condition, the benefit of an early diagnosis was so great that other states soon instituted the screening program. And once they adopted the practice, states expanded their scope and began testing for more conditions. 10 years ago, 46 states were screening for 6 conditions, and now all 50 states, including the District of Columbia, routinely screen newborns for at least 30 genetic conditions, with some states testing nearly twice that number. How nuts is that? And though each state runs its own program, every state has a DNA database. They all begin by collecting a blood spot from the heel of a newborn infant, and the sample is analyzed and results are returned. Commonly, the screening program is first mentioned when a mother is checked into the hospital for delivery, and generally, the programs are mandatory under state law. That this information comes so late in the game is a, quote, longstanding issue and controversy to a certain extent in the newborn screening field, says Jeffrey Botkin of the Secretary's Advisory Committee of Heritable Disorders in Newborns and Children, which advises the Department of Health and Human Services, yeah, another one that's involved in all these mad science gone mad projects, on newborn screening. In the 1960s, when the program was first developed, the feeling was, quote, that the advantages for newborn screening were so compelling that it was appropriate or acceptable to have states simply mandate the screening, he says. Now 43 states allow the parents to decline the screening process based on religious belief or philosophical reasons, but rarely, though, is that option exercised. And no, because when you're in labor in the hospital or even having a bad time of it, you're so freaking delirious, man. They're giving you all these papers to sign. You don't know what you're signing. They're just like, yeah, ink here, here, and here, initials here. Some believe that the reason is that most parents only hear about the program, and yes, this is exactly it, having lived through it, in the hectic period after a mother in labor enters the hospital, and that is exactly it. I think if people actually sat back and thought about it, and maybe they sent these papers like a month ahead of time before your expected due date to read through and research, people would not be signing on to this. It says, quote, these newborn screening DNA databases make a complete mockery of informed consent, says Jeremy Groomer, a president of the Council for Responsible Genetics, tells Newsweek. And what people also don't know is that this is the one test that is not done by the hospital or a third party on behalf of the hospital. It is done by the State Department of Public Health. In most states, blood spots are transferred to the long-term storage banks run by the State Department of Health, where they are retained for at least a couple of years. But in 12 states, samples are kept in the biobank for 21 years or longer. And that is because increasingly the health departments are using and sharing the genetic information for research and analysis. This practice has accelerated since 2009 when the National Institute of Health, yes, awarded a contract to the American College of Medical Genetics and Genomics, more affectionately known as ACMG, to establish a newborn screening translational research network and develop a national repository of newborn DNA, quote, stored by state newborn screening programs and other resources, unquote. Meanwhile, California, Iowa, Michigan, and New York already participate in a virtual repository which allows researchers to access data and, in some cases, the stored infant blood spots themselves for their investigations. This expansion of newborn screening programs will continue to create new opportunities for big research ventures. And as DNA sequencing becomes cheaper and more accessible, yes, we found out $99 up front. Many predict whole genome sequencing will replace the current blood spot testing. And according to ACMG Executive Director Michael S. Watson, the NIH has already awarded research grants to explore the feasibility of integrating whole genome sequencing into newborn screening. And I am going to guess that the fact that they just entered into a partnership with 23andMe has something to do with that. Oh, but look, there's more. Monetizing the human genome is the next section. It has been more than a decade since the human genome was first sequenced, and every week it seems there is new research identifying a mutation to predict some dreaded disease. It is now understood, for example, that variants of the APOE gene may increase the risk of Alzheimer's, yes, and that the BRCA gene mutation may double the risk of breast cancer. In many cases, though, it's still unclear how one genetic mutation may affect another person's health, and scientists will need lots and lots and lots of DNA samples, which what the Precision Medicine Initiative. We got a million volunteers that are ready to do it. Lots and lots and lots and lots of DNA samples to translate the wealth of information found in any one genome. It is only by comparison that they can understand how, when, and which genes matter separate from the environment. But for instance, 23andMe, a consumer genetics company, will genotype your DNA and provide you with ancestry-related reports and raw data. Yes, and previously, but then the kibosh put on it by the Food and Drug Administration, they were telling you about what genes you had with potential future disease. I don't know. We can, like, continue on and on here. There are some protections that exist. There is a law called the Genetic Information and Non-Discrimination Act, more affectionately known as GINA, G-I-N-A, which became law in 2008 and prohibits health insurance companies from using genetic information to make eligibility, coverage, or premium setting decisions. Well, phew, I'm sure that that'll stay intact. The law also prevents employers from using genetic data in their decisions about hiring, firing, and promotions. However, GINA has gaps. For example, the law does not apply to companies with fewer than 15 employees or the U.S. military, and it also does not cover long-term care insurance, life insurance, or disability insurance. For instance, having discovered you have the BRCA gene that raises your risk for breast cancer, a company can legally deny you a life insurance policy. Holy shit. Says, nevertheless, your DNA is a treasure trove of personal information, including your eye color, hair color, paternity, and health. And they liken this to a file cabinet containing your most secret documents, except with DNA, it's more as if you are walking around with these documents, and anyone with the proper tools can now open your filing cabinet and find out all about you. The fact is, you shed DNA daily in countless public places, and though you probably instinctively feel your DNA and sequence genome is yours, you have no real ownership rights, especially since your DNA has been entered into a data bank. And that is true. We saw at one point that some woman was making DNA art, picking up chewing gum and cigarette butts from the New York City streets. and then using DNA tools to create likeness images of the people who dropped them. You know, I mean, that's just pretty insane. Here, let's read one more thing. The search for exceptional genes, and this is where I really want to point to the danger, because we found out already from DARPA that they were going to be not only databasing all of this genomic data, but then trying to distinguish between special traits that people have, so they could, at the touch of a button, create life on demand with the best traits. It says, the search for exceptional genes, they walk among us, natural experiments, living ordinary lives, unaware that their genes may hold clues to the next superdrug. Yes. 10 years ago, scientists discovered that some people are naturally missing working copies of a gene known as PCSK9, and the consequences of that mutation were extraordinary. These people, including a Texas fitness instructor, a woman from Zimbabwe, and a 49-year-old Frenchman, had almost no bad cholesterol in their blood. Otherwise, they were perfectly normal. Drug companies pounced on the clue. To lower cholesterol, they would also try to block the PCSK9. And now two separate drugs that disable the gene's activity are nearing FDA approval. And this is where we get into RNAi technology, being able to block genes, turn switches on and off, and create ways to manipulate and control processes within the human body. And of course, they are waiting the FDA approval. I am sure that there will be some willing participants that will raise their hand to be the guinea pig. People taking the medications have seen their cholesterol, so they're already people, have seen their cholesterol levels plummet dramatically, sometimes by as much as 75%. Regeneron Pharmaceuticals, the company behind one of these drugs, Regeneron, R-E-G-E-N-E-R-O-N, now says it is building a giant database, another one, a giant database of human DNA information in what amounts to a large-scale systematic search for the next PCSK9. In a new genetic research facility that Regeneron completed last month in Tarrytown, New York, the company says that it has begun a 5-year effort to sequence the genomes as many as 100,000 volunteers recruited from the East Coast hospitals and identify rare genetic outliers among them. So far, 13,000 people's DNAs have been partially decoded, and the company is using software to search for deleted genes by checking against the volunteers' medical records or by calling them in for intensive testing. The company expects to learn if these missing genes cause illness or perhaps also have unusual protective effects. I mean, do you guys get, like, when they start determining, when they crack all the genome and determine what is a good gene and what is a bad gene and what causes disease and what doesn't, it'll be very easy for them in a newborn database to determine who is good breeding stock and who is not, who is going to live long and who isn't, who has rare genes and who doesn't. Very much like how we were looking at cloning technology, where they actually look at traits, and they weren't doing it at a genetic level. They were just looking at traits and bred traits into new animals and then making the decision as to which animals get to be bred again because of their superior traits. Rapidly expanding databases of human genome mean that researchers can now find knockout people instead. And to scientists, that's going to be a valuable shortcut to determine what humans' genes do. And we found out yesterday that there's a new company within 23andMe where they are going to start developing pharmaceutical drugs based upon some of the same, very same research. Says to drug companies, these individuals promise living, breathing answers to some of the biggest questions they face, like whether their drugs will actually work or whether blocking a given gene would be safe to do instead of causing problems. It is a huge emphasis for us because these are incredibly informative, natural human experiments, says Arias Barras, director of what? Oh, the R&D initiatives for the company. And I told you it's all about getting rid of the R&D line item budgets because there are shareholders. Remember, people. Says this is going to be a major model of human disease research going forward, says cardiovascular specialist at Massachusetts General Hospital who advises Regeneron. Drug companies are betting millions on drugs that cure animals or work in a lab in a petri dish, but 90% of the drugs tested in human studies show no beneficial effect or prove toxic. So animals don't predict people, and the concept now is to leverage the successes of the human genome and develop medicines that mimic them. So how awesome is that? Mad science gone mad. I think we're going to end Friday on a happy note here, if I can get there. I have all my tabs up and not one page. Here we go. All right. So all the research funding for all the mad science gone mad, the hospitals, the academics, the national institutes, the federal government, they're all in cahoots. And not only here, but across the globe, it seems. DNA databasing, biometrics, determining who is worthy and who is not through their genes. This is going to be a brave new world. But hey, don't worry about it, because guess what? NASA is now funding new research on a project to turn human poop into food. Yes, into food. NASA has funded researchers a $200,000 a year study to analyze how to recycle human feces into what? Yes, synthetic food. The project, which will be funded for up to 3 years, aims to help astronauts sustain food on a deep space exploration or an extended journey to Mars. Yes, makes you want to be the first one on that Mars bus, doesn't it? NASA is researching ways to recycle human waste into food during long space journeys. And I believe on the space station, they are already recycling urine into water. And how is this going to work? I mean, for the Alzheimer's and whatever, I mean, does it get passed through secretions? Because this might put a big kibosh on that. Living on Mars or making long space explorations may have its price to pay by space adventurers having to make their own food out of their own excrement. NASA has awarded a $200,000 grant to 8 universities in the U.S., and these teams have a 3-year research window for solving the most important needs for space exploration in the future. And if I'm not mistaken, we already had a Japanese scientist come up with poop burgers quite a few years ago. The name of the proposed project is Synthetic Biology for Recycling Human Waste into Food, Nutraceuticals, and Minerals, Closing the Loop for Long-Term Space Travel. And I've already talked about synthetic biology and nutraceuticals, guys. This is where our future is going to be, and it'll all be 3D printed with a pretty little bow. All right, guys, we're going to have to end right here, because if you can believe it, an hour is gone, but it is Friday, so make sure you stick around. Mrs. Lonnie Clark is up next with The Age of Fission. And then Josh is live tonight at 6 p.m. Eastern Prime Time with the boys at 8. Truth on the Tracks with Brandon at 9. Reality Bites brand new at 10. And Anti-Media with LeBon at 11. Make sure you're here for the weekend as well. Have an awesome weekend.